My mandate this morning is to try to familiarize you with the halachos that I think anybody who's a member of a Chevra Kadisha have to know backwards and forwards. I mean, sometimes in halacha you have the ability to take the availability of looking in a sefer momentarily to look up a sheila halacha lamasa. When it comes to Hilchos Avelos, a Rav must know this information on the spot, on the moment. It has to be committed not only to memory but to understanding, because many times you will not be in a situation to have a sefer available to you, especially when it comes to dealing with funerals, which unfortunately sometimes happen at the least appropriate time, as Rabbi Rosenblatt this morning. Anybody who's in our industry will tell you to take the availability of looking in a sefer momentarily to look up a sheila halacha lamasa. When it comes to Hilchos Avelos, a Rav must know this information on the spot, on the moment. It has to be committed not only to memory but to understanding, because many times you will not be in a situation to have a sefer available to you, especially when it comes to dealing with funerals, which unfortunately sometimes happen at the least appropriate time, as Rabbi Rosenblatt this morning. Anybody who's in our industry will tell you that this is one sug of halachot that a Rav must be a phenomenal expert in. I don't expect this morning to teach you kula tera kula regalachas, but obviously that's what you have an ongoing course on this topic for the next couple of weeks. But what I want to do this morning is to try to bring you into the halacha lamasa that relates to these issues. And I have my mekaros in front of you for you to see the actual halachas inside the mekaros, and the rest of it is zil gemar. Let's start off with what I would call the halachas of goseis. In the time of antiquity, the Chevra Kadisha used to be called to the place where the person himself was about to expire, about to die. That person in halacha literature was called a goseis. A goseis in English is rendered as a moribund patient, a patient who Chazal approximated is going to die within the next 72 hours. When it came to dealing with this individual, Chazal were aware of the fact this person is very delicate physically, psychologically, and therefore Chazal forewarned the people who were involved with this individual not to touch the body inordinately unless there is a tzorech hakoli, unless there's some way of physically, medically helping this person and giving them painkillers or taking care of other needs before they expire from this world. In your Yomar Mekamos, you have Simin Shin Lamites, which is quotation 1a, which delineates in Hilchos Yeradeya the halachas of how we treat a ghost, how ghosts are etachai, l'chol devarav, that this person that we're dealing with, even if he's deathly ill, still had his mental clarity. He was able to basically give his wife a get. He was able basically to give a shchiv marah matana to various people. And therefore, even though he has his mental clarity, his physiological status has deteriorated to the point that he has phenomenal fragility when it comes to his physical manipulation of his body. What the basic thrust of the Mechaber in Halacha Aleph of this Simon basically discusses is the fact that the Chevra Kadisha have no right to prep the body before the person expires. You have to take into consideration the fact that when the Shulchan Aruch was written, we were living in the Mideast. In the Far East, the climate was phenomenally hot. There wasn't any refrigeration. And there was a phenomenal desire by the Chevra Kadisha and others to try to get that body into the ground as quickly as possible. You all have learned, I'm sure, there's the Isser of La Solon, of La Sola Eitz, Pasach Kiseitze, which Chazal derived, the Isser, the Reis of Nivel HaMess. You can't cause the mess to undergo undue Nivel. You cannot manavel the mess. And likewise, you can't allow this to happen. And therefore, obviously, it was of the interest of the mess, as well as the interest of the family of the mess, and under halachic jurisdiction of the Chevra Kadisha to get that person buried in the ground as quickly as we possibly can. Since part of the pre-burial procedures is basically prepping the body, washing the body, cleaning the body, as we'll get to a little later on, what they were basically told is none of that preparation can take place when the person is still alive, because by physically manipulating that person's body, you might cause them to die a couple of seconds earlier, and therefore you could be chayiv for gram shvichas hadamim. Chazal or Madama goes to a ner hametaftei, basically to a flame on a candle, and obviously if you touch the flame inordinately, you can cause it to be extinguished. So therefore, Chazal told the Chevra Kadisha, you can watch, you can say Tehillim, but you physically cannot manipulate the body to get the body prepped until the person expires. You cannot even take the body, the Shulchan Aruch says, and put it on the ground to keep the body cool so that when it finally expires, the body should not start to swell, which it does, especially in a hot atmosphere. This would all be under the halachic fear of inordinately moving the body for no constructive therapeutic purpose, which would be halachically forbidden. The Shulchan Aruch points out not only physiological movement, But for instance, what happens if people wanted to talk over with the cholder their funeral arrangements? They wanted to give him a preheat on the hespedim. You basically speaking wanted to ask the cholder to pick out his oven, to pick out his tachrichin. So the Shulchan Aruch says over here, you know, it sounds like a nice idea, but nevertheless, if a person's dying in bed, he does not want to be reminded he's going to die in the next 2 minutes, and therefore, if he would cause him psychological trauma and as a result of this, he would die and expire, this is likewise counterproductive. The only time you'd be allowed to discuss burial arrangement if the cholah brought it up. Make sure you bury me in that burial plot, or I want these tachrichim. If he initiates or she initiates it, then obviously, the whole concept, the Gemara Basra talks about shumara, is to basically speaking give the person the ayishav adas, the last minute that they're in this world. So if they precipitate the entire discussion, unquestionably these things can be discussed. But for you to bring it up when they don't even want to think about it, is halakhically and basically, based upon mental kite, inappropriate according to the full format of the Shulchan Aruch. I want to mention to you that according to Chazal, you cannot be makar misasu, you can't cause the death to take place earlier. And for that reason, the Shulchan Aruch itself said very blatantly, whether you're doing that verbally or physically is prohibited. There is one thing you're allowed to do halachically, which the Rambam mentions at the end of the Simin, towards the end, where he discusses the concept of what's called hasaras hamoneya, removing impediments to death. And according to the Rambam, you have halachically the right to remove impediments to death. So what are some examples of removing impediments to death? So the Rambam quotes two that were prevalent in this time. One was the concept of their belief that by putting salt on the tongue of the cholah, it caused the chemical stimulation to keep the person's blood flow continuing to flow, and therefore quite obviously kept the person alive. If you would take the tongue off, the salt off their tongue, the stimulant would be taken away and they would be allowed to expire the derech hateva. So one hasara samanei mentioned by the Rambam is removal of the salt from the tip of the tongue. The second type of impediment to death you can remove was the famous Sefer HaChassidim, which referred to the chopping of the wood chop in the backdrop. There was a belief that if there's turbulence in the atmosphere where the person is dying, that turbulence does not allow the Yetzias HaNeshama to take place. So therefore, the Sefer Chassidim is advised that if you want to allow this person to have Yetzias HaNeshama b'menucha, you tell the wood chopper to stop chopping wood momentarily. Once there's silence, the person can expire in peace, and therefore the person can go to the Olam HaEmes. These are the two types of Hasaras HaMeneya mentioned by the Rambam. How will these practically apply in Halacha LaMaaseh today? So I want to point out to you that the Rambam lived approximately in the 1500s, 1600s, that the first group of poskim that tried to give a halacha conceptualization of the Rambam in a contemporary halachic format were two gedolim who lived in the 1700s. One was the author of the Shelos and Shuvas Beis Yaakov, the other one was the author of the Shelos and Shuvas Shvus Yaakov, Rav Yaakov Reisha. And basically their debate resolved around one specific nekuda. And that is, when the Rambam says, Hasaras HaMeneyim, you can take away impediments to death, does that mean that you can stop treating the person medically because of the fact he's, at this point, incurable? There's nothing therapeutically to do for this person anymore. The Beis Yaakov Paskin, that's exactly what the Rambam meant. The Rambam gave funny examples, but what the Rambam is really saying is, one's ability to cause refuah no longer was there, the person was going to expire, whether you like it or not. It was an end-stage terminal disease. The halacha was, as far as we're concerned, that you had to take away the impediments to death, in this case, medical treatment that has no medical value, to let the person have nature take its course. And that was the psak of the Beis Yaakov. I want you to be aware of the fact that Gedolim in the 20th century, namely, Rav Chaim David Halevi, paskin like this Beis Yaakov, he went as far as the paskin based upon this, that you can even remove a respirator in order to prevent the let a cholah basically pass away. That's called removal of impediment to death. Rav Libis, who's one of the Gedolim today of the Yid HaRabban and Beis Din, basically disagreed when it came to removing a respirator. He felt that's more gromis hamisa than hasaras hamaneya. But what Rav Libis did allow you to do is to remove all different types of intravenous medicine as well as intravenous feeding. He felt this is basically said more medicinal than hamaisa shalachila. And therefore, based upon Rav Libis' interpretation, possibly the Beis Yaakov, this removal, these impediments to death, can halakhically be justified based upon the psak of this Rambam. On the other side of the coin, you have Baal Shvus Yaakov, who was of the opinion that as long as the person is physically alive in this world, you must administer normal medical types of techniques until the person expires. If that's the case, and I want you to know halakh lamasa, this is the way that Tzitz Eliezer Paskin, the famous of Waldenberg in Eretz Israel, as well as the Chafetz Chaim,
in Simon Shin Chav Tes in Or HaChayim, the Bir Halacha, he passes like the Shita of the Shvus Yaakov. If that's the case, the obvious question you have to ask yourself, what is Hasaras Hamaneah mentioned by the Rambam? What does that concept mean? So according to the Shvus Yaakov, he says you have to basically take the Chiddush the way the Rambam formulated it, and what the Rambam was basically referring to is in Yonei Skula, supernatural phenomena. Salt on a person's tongue, a wood chopper with the turbulence in the backdrop cannot be logically, medically justified to maintain human life. So to remove the supernatural phenomenon, that's halachically allowed. But once you come into therapeutic, medical types of procedures, that, according to the Shvus Yaakov, definitely speaking, must be continued until the person expires.
He's saying even to them, on salt was just a
school? In other words, as far as even in that time, it was, in the respect of the Shvus Yaakov, more of a segula than an actual medical treatment itself. They knew it worked, but it surely wasn't in the gedder of full beduka, and that type of concept which you have in the Gemara Masechtas Yoma. For that reason, if it worked, you go with it. Amulets worked as well in their minds, so obviously they used it. But that doesn't mean amulet all became a full beduka by the fact it was able to maintain the longevity of a person's life. Now, halacha lamasa, and this you have to know, the way we paskin is not clearly the Shvus Yaakov or the Beis Yaakov, but two gedolei hadarim, Meshefayim Zatzal, Erel Shlomo Zalman Arbach, Gedolei Lechayim, came to a psak halacha that I would basically call is a midpoint between these two extreme shitas. And basically the formulation I'm going to give you now is the way that they finally come to a consensus opinion of how you deal with this type of situation. In the mind of Rav Moshe, in the mind of Rav Orbach, whether or not you continue medical treatment depends upon one factor. Is the medical treatment therapeutically efficacious? Is it going to help the scholar either arrest the medical condition or basically speaking cure the medical condition? Under those conditions, according to Rav Moshe and Orbach, if it's one of those two, then you must maintain this medical treatment until you complete your act. If, however, the medical treatment is not going to arrest the condition, nor is the medical treatment, basically speaking, going to terminate the condition, but the person is only going to be prolonged in pain and agony for X amount of time, this is one of the few times in halacha, Rav Moshe and Rav Orbach point out, that you have the right of patient autonomy. That the patient, if he's capable, should be asked, do you want us by chemotherapy to prolong your life a little longer? Or do you want us basically to cease and desist and let nature take its course? Over here, this is one of the classical cases that the concept of the yecholus for a person to make that decision is allowed to be made, and it's not considered as if you're literally mekatzi yomo, you're basically destroying yourself by making a decision not to treat any further and to let nature take its course. The classical example of this, Rabbi Yisrael, would be a person who's undergoing chemotherapy where he has, like, say, for instance, liver cancer, Rahman al-Islam, or he has pancreatic cancer. These are two cancers medical science so far have not been able to cure. We're able to perhaps prolong the life by giving them chemotherapy, but you cannot arrest this condition. Over here, the cholo will be allowed to make a decision whether or not he or she wants to maintain the chemotherapy to prolong the life a little longer, or they can basically say, since it's not going to cure me anyway, and it's not going to arrest the condition, I'd rather let nature take its course, shavei al tasa, and this will come under the head of hasaras hamaneah mentioned by the Ramah in Simin Shin Lamed Tes. These halachas, not only from Kaddish has to know, these halachas that any rabbi has to know at his fingertips, because many times you will not be able to run to Yiradei, you won't be able to run to Rabbi Tam or anybody else.
And but, feeding
yeah, I'm going to get to that right now. When it comes to, however, artificial feeding, over here I want to mention to you that Rav Moshe and Rav Arbach are phenomenally adamant that there should not even be contemplated in your mind removal of artificial feeding tubes. The reason behind this very simply is, as Rav Moshe says very beautifully, giving a human being food is as basic to any type of maintenance of human existence in this world. You're not allowed the rights to remove food from animals. In fact, you're supposed to feed the animals before you eat in the Suda. Surely you'll be chiv to feed a human being before basically they expire from this world. So as far as our emotions are concerned, or Arba, it's unconscionable for a person to take away food, even like intravenously fed food, until the person expires. The same thing applies to hydration, giving them liquids if they're not able to imbibe the liquids through their actual mouth itself. This must be given to the patient until they basically expire. Intravenous medicines, if the medicine doesn't help anymore, but obviously you can remove this intravenous medicine by not refilling it once the medicine basically goes out and is no longer available. I do want to mention to you that according to the poskim over here, this concept of goses is so crucial that there was an interesting medical study done in a British hospital that was later on reported by the Lancet magazine. Lancet was the famous British medical journal. The question arose that they realized that there was a phenomenal, interesting thing happening, that patients that were in a regular hospital room, And patients who were basically speaking in a ICU unit with the same type of level of disease, for some reason people in the ICU unit were dying earlier than people in the regular hospital room. And could obviously have fascinated them. You would think it would be just the opposite. There's so much intensive nursing care in the ICU unit, they should be living longer than those in the regular hospital room. What they came to the conclusion over here is that what they were not aware of, halachas of gesisa. They realized what was causing the patients to die earlier was the undue physical manipulation of the cholera's body, which was surely not taking place in a normal hospital room. How about they come when you push the button, let alone when you don't push the button? In the ICU unit, they don't let you live up with it. They check you in the shama day and night. If you've ever been in an ICU unit, you understand what I mean. This unneeded nursing care caused undue physical trauma in the body. It was the Negiya Shel Gesisa that's mentioned by the Shulchan Aruch. And they finally came to the conclusion at this point in time that when a person is that deathly ill, it might be more advisable to recommend hospice or put him in a regular hospital room than to put him into intensive care. So therefore, at this point in time, what Rav Auerbach from Moshe said, when you have a cholera this sick, what you should really tell the hospital is that you would prefer what they call TLC, tender loving care, which means if you're able to convince the hospital, no longer giving them blood tests if they're not needed anymore. They're going to die anyway, the blood tests are not going to enhance anything. They stop giving them every 10, 15 minutes blood pressure tests. To give basically this test, that test, which are not needed. They're just being done to give the doctors and nurses to say that they've done something in the ICU unit, but they're not medically needed. If you can convince them not to do undue testing, you'd be doing a mitzvah gedola to prevent undue negia to a goseis, as is stipulated by halacha. Sometimes the hospital will just listen to you, sometimes the hospital will not. But one thing is for sure, if you're able to advise them to do such and willing to listen to you, yesh mitzvah gedola to mashvi upon them to prevent the cholera from dying earlier by undue manipulation of the body that is not medically needed. Now, let us continue. One of the things the Chevra Gadish and a Rabbi usually involved in, especially if the person has mental clarity, is to say what's called the vidui of the Shechiv Mera. To basically say vidui with the person, there are different schos of the vidui. The Shulchan Aruch itself has its own nusach of vidui. On Simin Shin Lamed Ches, you have the vidui of the Ramban quoted. And over here, I want to mention to you one important fact. You'll ask me the question, but how can you say vidu with the chola? Aren't we supposed to not subject the chola to psychological trauma that he shouldn't die earlier? If you're telling the person to do vidu, what obviously isn't this a violation of a specific concept? So over here, the phraseology of the Shulchan Aruch is brilliant. What the Shulchan Aruch says over here is that you go to the chola and tell them, I'm not saying you should say vidu because you're going to die. What I'm saying to you as a security policy, as a guarantee that if God forbid you do die, you should have had the ability to do vidui, kodim yisasa, that you should have total kapara and total tshuva. So for this reason, say the vidui with me. There are many people who have said vidui that have lived nevertheless. There are many people who are superstitious, foolish, and didn't take advantage of the vidui, and they died, and they weren't able to have this last tahira of tshuva being done with their minds and their mouths before they basically expired. By making and phrasing in this way, you basically take away the psychological trauma, but at least you mazak this person that if they do die, they've said the vidu, kodim yisasa, and this facilitates the tshuva and gives an neshama, great yicholis, to go to olam emes in a quicker fashion. So this usually a rav's called in to participate in, usually you'll have a chevra kadish if they're available to do this, in order to give this person this last chus, this last will and testament to say to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, if I did commit anything during my lifetime, my misa should be my kapav, and therefore I should be able to get olam haba without any undue spiritual impediments. So this is an important factor which the chevra kadish and rabbanim involved towards the end of their life. One interesting question people always ask rabbanim, or members of the chevra kadisha, if a person is dying from incurable cancer, should I pray to God that he should die? What should I pray? I mean, you know that medical science can no longer cure this person. A person is brain dead. Medical science has never been able to resurrect a brain dead person yet. Should I pray that God should allow him to die and expire? Or should I pray to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that a nesh should happen, and basically speaking, he should be cured from something which we know cannot be cured by Derech HaTeva? This ended up, interesting enough, to be a machlokes between Rav Moshe and Waldenberg, based upon a very famous case in Maseches Ksubos and Daf Kuf Dalet. In your Ma'amar Makamos, you should have the Gemara Maseches Ksubos on page number 2C, where the Gemara talks about the famous Amsa de Rebbe, the famous sagacious maidservant of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. Chazal tell us that that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, towards the end of his life, was stricken with a terrible gastric intestinal illness. He had excruciating pains, excruciating different types of yisurim. And it seems that the Amsa de Rebbe and the Talmidim of Yehuda Nasi had a debate whether they should pray to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that he should die or he should live based upon seeing how he was never subject to his yisurim. She opted, you should pray he should die. The Talmidim out did Yisha pray Yishalif. And the Gemara tells a story where she did openly speaking to get her way. She threw a pitcher down, she sung at the Rabbanim by that terrible crash. At that point she prayed that he should die and he expired, and the Gemara at the end doesn't seem to give her any ridicule for doing what she did. It seems we have a new concept of Maisa Rav, in this case Maisa Amsa, that this concept, what she did, is brought down Halakha L'Maaseh by the Ran, in Masechta Sedarim, this is quotation 2D, where he brings down, based upon this Maisa, that we see there sometimes when a person is Mevakeh Cholin. There's no question people who are involved in Rabbanus or Sefer Kadisha have to be involved in Mevakeh Cholin before they get involved in Nicham Avelim, if they possibly can keep the person alive. So they should try that rather than trying to opt that they should not be alive anymore. That when you're Mevakeh Cholin, part of the Bikur Cholim, the word Bikur means you investigate the needs of the Cholim. The Gemara records where Rabbi Kiva used to investigate the needs of the Cholim. If he saw the room was dirty, he used to sweep the room to make it cleaner, that the Cholim should feel a little better. The atmospheric should be more conducive to healing. He used to see if the Cholim needed change of his medicines. Bikur means literally the concept of investigating the needs in Sarfei HaCholim. Besides the practical Bikur Cholim, you also have a concept of being mispalel on an neshama level to HaKadosh Baruch Hu on behalf of the Chol. That's the concept of the Hiratzon, that you are a mispalel that Hashem should send them a refuah shleimah, but besides the Shah Chol of Yisrael. That's the special Baruch, the special tefillah you recite on behalf of the Chol. Now, what happens if you go to the Chol and you see that he's incurably ill? Should you pray to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he should die or should you live? So the Ran over here, Paskins, based upon the Mice of Amsa de Rebbe, that we see that when you see the person is caught with an incurable illness, that if she prayed the person should die, that should be a Maisa Rav, that we should follow in suit. And that's the way the Ran passes Halacha Masa, using that specific Gemara in Ksubis as his marker to his Pesach Halacha. Interesting enough, Rav Osh in his Tshuvas brings down this Ran, and brings down the Gemara in Ksubis Halacha Masa, and in fact says, in his early Tshuvas, that if in fact you see a person incurably ill, that you should, at that point in time, perhaps pray that the person should die to take them out of Yisurim. After all, there is a concept of Hatarech Kamocha, and the Gemara dashes the Masechta Sanhedrin, Barla Misiyofa, that even a person who's Chayim is Bezdin, the Chazal used to give them some types of painkillers, they should die with a Misiyofa. So if a person's Chayim is Bezdin, he's supposed to facilitate, they should have a Misiyofa. Surely a person who's not Chayim Misa should try to make their death as beautiful and as painless as you possibly can. So the Rav Osh said, if that's the case, based upon the Psak of the Ran, following the Mahalach, Amsa the Rebbe, perhaps it's appropriate to pray they should die and say Tehillim for that reason. The Tzitz Eliezer takes a Moshe on it and he says, what's interesting to note, if we pass him like that Ran, and we pass him the Gemara Ksubis, why didn't the Ramban, the Rosh, or the Rif, the major poskim, bring that Gemara down Halach Lamasa? Why didn't Rabbi Yosef Karo, in any of the Halach, the Bika Kolim, bring that Gemara down Halach Lamasa? By the fact the poskim admitted it, indicates to Rabbi Waldenberg that Gemara is not Halach Lamasa. We don't pass him that way. And therefore he says, it's us up here to basically pray the person should die. You have to pray to Hashem that Hashem should do. To the fuels, if Hashem decides afterwards, that's Hashem's ratzon, but you should always pray in the positive. What's interesting to note, and then I'll continue your question, Rav Moshe, in the latter tshuvos, in Choshen Mishpat Beis, which is the last tshuvos we have in Rav Moshe, I wouldn't say he made an about face, but he qualified his statement. He said that, theoretically, I didn't change my opinion that we should follow Rabbi Yehuda Nasi's Amseis Derech Hayasha, and that is that theoretically you should pray a person should die if they're deathly ill. But the only thing I forgot to mention is you have to be on the dag of Amsa the Rebbe to basically say, if I pray he should live it and it's not accomplished, I can change my nusach. Since we're of his mind and not on the level of these people, who knows if we're worthy when we pray that a person should live, that Hashem wants to listen to our tefillahs, and therefore if we don't listen, it's an indication we should pray the opposite. And since we're not on that level, he says, we have no right to take that leniency, and therefore as far as we're concerned, either we should pray they shall live, or the bare minimum we're allowed to do is pray that Kodesh Baruch, whatever Hashem feels is appropriate should be done. We surely, if it's Manazesh, are not praying the negative because we're not on a dark to basically convey that type of chalata. What's your question?
What's the answer of praying that they should die? Is there an answer or is it just...
It's the question, you're asking a very good question. Whether or not this is considered Grama Samisa or not, there are some posts who wanted to say that you see there's an Issa Grama Samisa. Grama Samisa is not only when you physiologically do it, or physically do it, but perhaps even spiritually, you know, you're basically playing the role of a Kaddish Baruch Hu. For you to pray as a human being to make that type of statement, you don't know what Hashem has in mind for this person. I mean, you want him to be survived miraculously. Many times in medical science, I will tell you, the doctors have been convey a person is going to die in the next 3 days and live for the next 3 months. Since every minute of life has a crucial meaning, and since we pass the halach lamasa, chashin l'chayisho, the Gemara Masechta Yoma, Tehayim and Aleph, what that basically means is, as the Miri explains, even a net extra second of life has infinite value as far as we're concerned, and besides that, The person in those 2 minutes could be Mahari Bashubi, which would not be able to Mahari if you were Makatsa's Yamah, and they have to deny the person the tikkun in this world to be Zerf al Haba. It's based, therefore, on this specific soul that he felt it's inappropriate for us to play God in this type of situation, to pray a person should die. We should pray for Derech HaTeva, that the person should live, Hashem should save him. If Hashem decides not to, that's Hashem's Ratzon and his Yecholus, not human beings. That's the basic Mahalach of Rav Waldenberg. It feels out of our domain. It's not within human beings to decide life and death. Our Eve is Hatzalos Nefashos, not Mises Nefashos. Now, let's continue over here. When the expiration takes place, when a person expires, we call Yitzias HaNeshama. Now over here, I don't want to get into the big debate over here, what's considered Misa and that's for a separate shiur. Leave it just to say that the two opinions on the marketplace, separate is a separate topic. Separate topic, separate issue. Let me just say that the two shitas on the marketplace, one shita accepts brain death as halachically acceptable, that's my clear colleague Rabbi Tellman's opinion, and if you want more bira, I'm sure he'll be willing to give a shiur on it. The other shita holds that brain death is inadequate because in order to declare a person dead, you need both the cessation of not only respiratory factor and brain factor, but also cardiac factor. Which, if you take a consensus of person around the world today, that seems to be the majority opinion, not the minority opinion. Once again, it depends who you ask. That's another political question I'm not going to get into. When the person has been declared dead, it seems b'mei chazal, without the utilization of fancy machinery, what they used to do when they saw a person expire, when they saw a person stop breathing, is they used to do what's called the feather test. The feather test meant, once you see the person is no longer breathing, the person no longer breathing, automatically that means is, there's no longer any respiratory function. If a person has no longer any respiratory function, it means there's also been an automatic stoppage in cardiac function. The heart cannot function without oxygen. And the epiplasmatic gevura, it takes 2-3 minutes for that to happen, but 2-3 minutes. In the world of reality, an epiplasmatic machine, it's basically 2-3 minutes, according to medical sciences. Until the oxidification basically takes place. Be more specific, yeah. But we're dealing now with basically speaking the fact that once you basically have both of these mechanisms determined by a person waiting 15 to 20 minutes to do the feather test, nobody will ever be alive with Derech HaTeva without machinery keeping them going and giving them artificial oxygen. Therefore, the Chevra Kedishas of old used to wait 20, 30 minutes to do the feather test to basically see whether they're aspiring. Once they basically did that and they saw there's no longer air coming out, after 20, 30 minutes, they declare the person halakhically dead. There is an interesting question that Rav Orbach last year asked some doctors in Brooklyn, and that is, the minig is to wait 20 minutes, 50 minutes, 30 minutes. What's the real zman? This is a chumrah, there's no question about it. What's the bare minimal amount that you can tell me, according to doctors, can basically be said if a person is really dead, especially brain dead, and you take them off a respirator, what's the guaranteed time that after you take them off the respirator, there's no way of returning them back to life when you see in the stoppage of respiration and cardiac activity? So the doctors basically said that the real factor is approximately speaking from 30 to 60 seconds, which means once a person has stopped breathing and stopped cardiac activity, if you don't medically intervene, it becomes impossible to resuscitate them if you don't do anything within the next 30 to 60 seconds. The Derech HaTeva, the body will never have an ability in its own right to regenerate its breathing and its capacity, basically speaking, to have cardiac activity. In its own right. You can give them chemicals, you can give them shots, you can give them stimulants, but the Derech HaTeva, the body will not regenerate itself. It's based upon that, but Auerbach himself, Paskin, a very interesting psak, that he felt that once a person, especially is brain dead, and then is taken off the respirator, and you wait basically, he says, in his mind, 60 seconds, 30 to 60 seconds, he would then at that point in time, allow the person, could obviously, to, after they're taken off the respirator, and you wait after that point in time, about 2 minutes, he would then allow that person to undergo heart transplant, to take the heart from that person and transplant it to another person, which means he will pass him brain death is only indicative that you're falling in the last stage of gesisa. At that point in time, he will allow a person to be removed from the respirator, and after that, to wait 2-3 minutes, the person can be rolled into an operating theater as a dead person and the body used for the sake of Hatzalos Nefashos. That's a landmark Pesach Rav Orbach, which is like a middle Pesach between everybody else. But getting back to this specific issue, when the Yetzias HaNesham is there, the first thing that you do is you call in the Chevra Kedisha. What the Chevra Kedisha at this point can do is they try to make sure that the mess's body is munach b'kavod. What does that mean? You want to make sure the entire body is covered. You try to make sure the eyes are closed. You want to make sure that the hands and feet are positioned properly before rigor mortis sets in, which means because you want the body to look in as quiet setting as it possibly can in this type of state. Many times, if you know there's going to be undue delay, you try to get the body to refrigeration. This man said we have refrigeration. If you know that it's not going to get to the refrigerator, you put the body on the ground, but the Rech Menucha, take off the blankets, take off the clothing, to let it be cooled down, to keep the body temperature low. It shouldn't start to swell up and to start being filled with gases as a result of the putrefaction of the body itself internally. The Chevra Kedisha are the ones who normally are allowed, with the help of the local funeral parlor, to physically take the body and remove the body to the actual funeral parlor itself. But obviously, all that is done by the hands of a Jew is covered a mess, since most of the funeral parlors are manned by non-Jews. If the Chevra Kedisha could be involved in this type of activity, it is very meritorious. In the Queens community, our Chevra Kedisha have a special removal service, which is citywide available, and therefore, if we're called many times, when people need removal, and they know we are not called, they are going to do it, they call our removal service to bring it to any funeral parlor in the metropolitan area to take care of this specific service. We also have a Shmira service. I'm not trying to campaign and give a commercial now, but you should be aware of the fact that upon Patira, two things are necessary: the removal of the body, maintenance of Kavod Hames, and also Shmira. You have to do Shmira immediately. And Shmira means two things. There's the functional Shmira to prevent the body from undergoing nivel. There's Mana Gemara that meant preventing the body being eaten up from Achbarim, that rodents shouldn't come in and start eating at the body. That can be easily done by putting the body in the Makam and Mishtameres. Even putting the body momentarily in the freezers, in the morgue downstairs, is a shmira from the rodents, and Moshe allows that the body has to stay over Shabbos. It's a way of taking care of that specific problem. It will also prevent the problem from the body basically bloating up over that time period. When it comes to other shmir, which is more of a Kabbalistic shmir because of Rufus Ros, which I'm not going to get into, I'm not a specialist in Rufus Ros, there what you basically do is you use Dvar Moshe B'Kedusha, reciting Tefillin, saying Dibri Torah L'Kavod HaNeshama, all of this is done as a way of taking care of that specific shmir of the mess during that specific time period. Every Chevra Kedisha have different Yehugim, how shmir is done, whether the Shema has to be up continuously, whether he can sleep an hour of the service. That you look at your local Chevra Kedishas to ask them what is the minhagim of how the shmir is basically done. You can do a shmir multiple mesim at one time. There's no halacha of being siyachet, only one Shema per mes. It can be done in a group format without any halachic impediments. Now, another thing I want to mention to you that is done classically speaking upon the batir of a person is quite obviously the mitzvah of kriya. The Gemara says in Masechta Me'ikot, "B'shasi tzias and neshama, there was a chiyuv ikir hadin for a person to do kriya." The Gemara is medama this to a sefer Torah shenishkat. The same one when you see a burnt, destroyed sefer Torah, and you see this happening, you tear kriya as a shrine of avelus on the tzrei, the destruction of the sefer Torah. The same thing applies halachically when it comes to the destruction of a human being. The dimyon made by the Ramban to this very simply is the same way the cloth of the Sefer Torah is sanctified and is Kaddish by the existence of the Neshama there, likewise the goof of the human being is being miskaddish by the presence of the Neshama. And the Gemara later on says this is not just a homily, not just a, what we call it, a mushel. In actuality, we hold the goof of the human being has the Kedushas of goof of the Sefer Torah, and that is why the Chassam Sofer passes Halacha Mas, the Gemara says in Masechtas Megillah, that you're allowed to take one out of Sefer Torah, the actual coverings of Sefer Torah, which are worn out, instead of committing them to burial immediately, which is the way you basically show covet at the end of their usage, you can literally use them as tachrikam if needs be for Meisei Mitzvah. The Chassam Sofer said you could not have done that if the mess had less Kedusha than the actual Sefer Torah. It would be Shalom Morid Kedusha, Shalom Moridin, Veloy Malim. Since we pass on Allah Lamasa, you can utilize them as Tachrikim Eis, we therefore learn Allah Lamasa, that we therefore look upon the mess having the same Kedushas of Guf at the Sefer Torah, and therefore they can be used interchangeably when need be.
The wood of an
Aron Kodesh also is being basically Tashmita. The only thing over there is the question of how much Nagi they have to the Sefer Torah itself. It depends, the inner wood or the outer wood. Some parts make a difference. The inner wood, which actually facilitates touching the Sefer Torah, might what happened one half of halacha. That which is the outer surface of might have a different halacha. That's a debate amongst poskim, how far you do with it. When it comes to disposal in Aron HaKodesh, the question is whether they chayav kavura or not, or just the inner parts chayav kavura. Yes?
So you use the inner part, and then the inner parts, is there a full contact from Sefer Torah? So now they'll be used.
You can use that for Nara.
Right.
I would talk about a different thing, whether or not you have to commit to kavura in general, not for mess. Well, you have to commit to kavura the outer side of the aron, only in this part that really touches the actual physical essence of the sefer Torah. As a mitzvah kavura, when it comes to its lack of ishtamshus after it, if it's basically worn out and no longer usable, that's a machlokes among the poskim. Yes. When it comes to what halacha? Yes, and the reason is because it seems Rashi adds one little nakuda, and that is, it's not only a question that you nidmet to a sefer Torah, but also you learn Torah during a lifetime. And that's why some person had the question whether we should be mechalek between anoshim venoshim. I'm glad I'm not giving this in stern. Whether we should make this silik. There were some poskim who, in fact, because they wanted to say that since men are chayv and Talmud Torah and noshim are not, maybe the chiv should be on noshim but not noshim. What Rabbi Yosef Karo counteracts, and he says very simply, is Rabbi Yosef forgetting the fact that the pasuk halacha lamasin simin mem zayin arachayim noshim make a birchas parah each and every day, and the reason the Beis Yosef says we pass in that way is because noshim achayov is a little more than mitzvah shalahem, which means the nechlelos on some level the mitzvah Talmud Torah. If the nechlelos, if Rabbi Yosef says the nechlelos and the chetz of the mitzvah Talmud Torah, they therefore are surely doimed the people who learn Torah, therefore the chiv sreifa of kriyan on the destruction of human beings' lives should apply to men and women across the board, and that's the way we pass it. We do not differentiate between men and men. Between Goy and Jews, we would differentiate. There's a concept of Kavod Hames on some level, because there the Pesukim point out the din of Kavod Hames comes from the din of the Issa Nivel Hames. And there is a machlokes amongst the Rishon whether the Issa, the rice of Nivel Hames, applies to Goyim besides Jews. It applies to Jews, there's no question. Does it also apply to Goyim? I want you to be aware of the fact that this became a very hot debate when it came to the Shela of performing post-mortem autopsies on dead human beings' bodies. When it came to whether or not they should establish anatomy schools in Eretz Israel, Jewish bodies in Eretz Israel. And this became a hot debate between Rav Cook and Rav Uziel of whether or not the Easter of Nivel Mes can be basically counteracted by the concept of teaching students medical knowledge. We're not talking about Kuach Nefesh, we're talking about just teaching. So over here, the famous psak which Rav Cook gave, which you have in your Maamar Kamos just for your erudition, it's on page 2G, so you'll read it by Rechus inside. What Rav Cook paskin is that since the Issa of Nivel Mes only applies to Jews, it doesn't apply to non-Jews, then perhaps you should use non-Jewish bodies for the purpose of anatomical dissection, not Jewish bodies. Rav Uziel felt that since it's a covet for the Mes for his body to be used to enhance medical science, he felt there's a tzarek that's involved that could be mapped to the Nivel Mes. He'd have a paskin, they could use Jewish bodies for this specific purpose. So in the entire reason I don't want to go into that, because I'm from being Zion, whether a Jew can will the body for scientific research before they die, whether that's a lovely valid. Some Sofa said it isn't. The being Zion, basically Paskin, it is. How this relates to this topic is that there's a Machlos between Rashi and the Ramban. And Pashas Kisaytse, does the Issa Raisa of Nivel Mes, Lassol and Velasso, apply to Jews alone, or does it apply to Jews and non-Jews? Rashi says it applies only to Jews. Ramban seems to say it applies to Jews and non-Jews as well. And therefore, based upon, that's why Ramban says, when it came to killing the Goyim in the Mochemes Mitzvah, Kibush Eretz Israel, they committed all the bodies to burial, they should undergo Nivel Hames. This is the Psak of the Ramban. Rashi does the opinion, Nivel Hames only applies to people who have a Tzelem Elokim, but Klal Yisrael to do, it doesn't apply to a non-Jewish Tzelem Elokim. Which one?
He doesn't use the same comparison.
Who?
The Ramban.
The Ramban is the one who basically held halakha ma'asa that a human being is nidmer to a sefer Torah.
But
they
held that because of the
mitzvah. No. Basically, but he said, you know, in the hashkafa, the dimim between sefer Torah and Nisra, and the concept between the chiyah kriya, he basically is medama the kedushas of the human being to that of kedushas of the sefer Torah, the neshamas mekadesh the guf, the same way the haskaras mekadesh the actual chetz of the sefer Torah. But in this issue, interesting enough, there was a machlokes based upon Ramban and Rashi, how this reapplies to Goyim. But obviously speaking, if you claim Issa Nivel Mes does apply to Goyim, then but obviously speaking, you would have to be very careful when it comes to the post-mortem treatment of the body, when it comes to the hishtamishes for the guf, and how you basically deal with the remains. If you say there's no Issa Nivel Mes, there's only chiva kura to take away the tumor that's involved in the carcass, over there will be concept of committee at the burial, but to be no chayef of doing the tara on the body towards the end. In general, you should know there's a concept of daki shalom to be considered, and that is, but obviously you're involved in the chevrik adisha, and let's say politically you're supposed to, based upon your requirements, to take care of all mason that come past you. In the key of daki shalom, they have to say, if you prepare the body for Jews one way, they will require you to prepare the non-Jewish body the other way, they shouldn't say, you're being machal between another. That's kind of daki shalom that applies. Kerbe may say in may say Yisrael. It's a Rambam as Paskin based upon a Bryce and Receptus Gittin brought down by the Rambam at the end of Kukhis Molochim. So you have to be careful what comes to Dach Shalom when or not to differentiate when it's allowable, when it's not allowable. Now, getting back to this, where this is Nogeya Halach Lamas, the following. If people who are standing beside the Sisha have to do a Chiyah of Kriya, What does this mean vis-a-vis the mishpacha members? Does that mean everybody who's there at the time of death has to tear kriya? Mi'ikhi din, they really should. However, the meaning of Klal Yisrael today is to delay the kriya for people who wanted to delay kriya to the actual time of the service to the Zman HaPetzo SMS. That's the meaning that seems to be mekubal. There's no question halacha ma'aseh, if you would want to tear b'shas yitzias and neshama, that's the ideal time because the kriya should take place b'shas chimum, when you have the greatest emotional output. And usually when people see their mishpacha die on the spot, that's when you start to cry, you feel the greatest emotional output. However, those who do not want to take advantage of this, and most commonly the mishpacha never, for whatever psychological reasons, don't want to be in the room at the time of the diva. So by them, once you're delaying it, you delay it to the time of the chapel service, to the time of Haitzah SMS. The reason for that is based upon the fact that Chazal made the following hashara. They wanted to quality control kriya. And they realized the fact that there might be people who want to do kriya out there, to make the mitzvah, but they're not so bucky in how to perform kriya. There are halachas how you do kriya, which I'll get to very shortly. If not everybody's bucky how to do kriya, and sometimes if you don't do the kriya properly, not only haven't done the kind of kriya, but you also might be violating Baal Tashlish, a little above my mitzvah. What people don't realize is when you turn the beg in, the head of kriya allows you to overcome Baal Tashlish. I once saw a person in a Hasidic community with a kriya that was basically a foot long. So I asked him, why did you make such a long kriya? He said, I wanted to make sure everybody would see I'm tearing kriya, la halacha. So therefore, I felt that the tefach is the chiva mitzvah, I'm going to make some chayim. I'm going to make three tefachim to be yaitzel, l'chim mishur as I did. I'm machman everything else, I'll be machman kriya. What I pointed out in halacha what Nasa is you have to scribe as sefer, because what you did by tearing more than the tefach is you basically did kriya shalom b'mok and mitzvah's kriya, so the chiva kriya is only a tefach, more than that is not halacha sanctioned. It was Yom Tzitzchayim of Seder. You violate the Issa der Issa, if you hold the Issa of Baltashkes, or Issa der Rabbanim of Baltashkes. And therefore, what Chazal therefore said, since you realize that there's an Issa that has to be obviated over here, you have to do Kalacha, you have to know how to perform the Mrs. Kriya. The Chevra Kaddish from the time of antiquity used to be the specialists who were involved in teaching people how to perform the Kriya. And therefore, since the Chevra Kaddish were primarily involved at the Zman HaPetzo SMS, they were the ones who instructed the Mishpacha at that time how to tear Kriya Kalacha, and therefore that's what the meaning was, to delay it that historical point in time. I will mention to you that there is a Spanish meaning for those who are Sephardim in the room, or maybe about the Sephardim, to delay the Kriya to the time of the actual Kufula. Since the Lashon of the Gemara is that you basically do the Kriya Achi Yechasa, Mesoi, the character, until literally the actual message is interred, some Sephardim hold up the Kriya to the actual Kufula time. So there are basically three Minhagim at the exact time the Kriya is supposed to be done. One thing is for sure, that even if we delay the Kriya to the time of its SMS, that's also the second Zman HaChimah. If you've ever been involved in a funeral parlor service, you see the Mishpacha at the time of the Hespedim, if they didn't cry enough at the time he sees the Neshama, this is the second time they start to burst out and cry, and therefore that's a logical time to perform the Kriya. You should now, I'll only ask you the following question. Is Kriya Chiyah D'Raisa Chiyah D'Rabbanah? What's the keys in this? Are you Chiyah D'Raisa D'Rabbanah for the Kriya? Anybody know? So over here, you should be aware of the fact that there's a mimer of Shmuel in the Gemara in Moed Katar, where Shmuel basically says, Oval Shalapar Valparam, if an Oval did not perform the Chiyuv Kriya, Chayiv Misa. That's the Lashon of Shmuel. They bring the Pasuk from Yechezkel, where Yechezkel was told, Roshecham Al Tifra, when Udechel Al Siframu, where he was told not to perform Kriya because of his special status, it means other Avelim have a Chiyuv to tear Kriya. The Raivid holds the Chiyuv of Kriya is a Deraisa, this Drush is a Drush Gemura. The Ramban held the concept of Kriya is merely Midarabanan. And this is therefore machlokes amongst the poskim over here.
Any difference in relatives there, or was that about
obeying? When you talk about in general, the whole yisoid of kriya, Now, the poskim over here point out that since there is a chiyav of kriya, the obvious question is: do you have a right to change your begadim to a special begad upon which to do kriya, or do you have to do kriya on the begad you're found with at that point in time, at the time of his chayvus? What the postman point out is that technically speaking, you'll be allowed to change your begadim to tear kriya on a special begad. You don't have to tear the kriya upon the begad you're wearing at that point in time. In fact, one of the Balei Taisa, Rebbeinu Peretz, used to have a special begad miyuchad of the begad shel kriya. Anytime he had a chiyuv kriya, he used to take that begad out and tear a kriya upon it to fulfill the specific mitzvah mandate. The only difference, however, between Av and Ein and Shad Krogan relates to the following factor. What happens during the week of Shiva? If I change my begadim, by other Ein, if I would change my begadim during the week of Shiva, I would have to tear a kriya a second time. If, however, on Shad Krogan, I change my begadim during the week of Shiva, I would have to tear a second kriya. That would have major halachic significance. The mishpachas tell you, I'm wearing this shirt or this blouse, I look like I can't stand it anymore, it's dirty, it's filthy, can I change it? So not going to be halacha maaser who there are other lapan. If there are other lapan, and you have to, for one, you change your beged, you're going to have to tear a second kriya. If it's on shak, you're going to have to tear a second kriya. The Gesher HaChayim of Tukachinsky, in order to give a lumdish and chilek over here, says the difference between kriyas av ein and kriya shak roim is the following. On shak roim, the chiyah is a maaser kriya. And once I perform that maaser kriya, I fulfill the mitzvah. On shak roim, the chiyah is when Israel is kriya begotten. I have to appear kriya begotten during the entire time period. Therefore, if I obviate that, by changing my begotten, I would therefore have to recreate the Israel is kriya begotten by doing a second kriya during the actual Zmanishik itself. What?
Okay, yeah.
As far as Aviyah. And as Aviyah, the Kriya does not merely do Maisa Kriya, but to appear Kriya begun during the week of Shiva, on Shakrayim, Kriya is a Maisa Kriya. Another important factor. By Shakrayim, you have this Zman up until the end of Shiva, which means I'm getting there very shortly. On Shakrayim, you have the Kriya Kriya during the week of Shiva. If I basically, during the week of Shiva, didn't do the Kriya, I cannot make it up. It's of Zman Abakul Kabano. On other aim, even if I miss during the Shiva, I basically can always do. There's no Zman. When I find out about the problem, I can basically get free at that point in time. Even after Shloshim, yes. Now, even after you Befodesh, theoretically. Olam. Washington Gemara is the Olam forever. Now, there are major halakhic differences in how you do Kriya on other aim in comparison to other programs. Let me give you the rivals. When it comes to Kriya on Shah Kravim, the Kriya is done on the right side. That's number one. Number two, the Kriya can be done with a cutting implement, if you want. Number three, the Kriya is done what's called Beged Elyon. Beged Elyon could mean, theoretically, a blouse, a shirt. We happen to pass in like the Shita of the Shach, quoting the famous Masas Binyamin, and Rav Shulchan passes away as well, the Beged Elyon means a jacket. And therefore, the Allah is, you should hear what's called the Beged Elyon on that person. No, you have to cut the underwear. Some people could obviously, if they're wearing a coat outside, where some person wanted to say perhaps that also would be higher, they basically move that coat to take it themselves out of the shela. But so therefore, it's basically the jacket plus the shirt itself. The kriya Rabbi Yisai must be done vertically, from top to bottom. Many people make a mistake, they think if they make horizontal kriyas, you get to the mitzvah. It's not correct. Yeah, like a jacket like this, Rabbi Mangalat's lung, you're not supposed to show, but horizontally would not be sufficient. You have to cut in, and then basically tear down to have basically a vertical cut itself. A tefet, there's a machloikis, the Ramosha holds a tefet is about 3.5 inches. The Chazanis says that's 3.8 inches. If you are approximating, you're allowed to approximate. In other words, since Magnitin Atel Machle Shares, if you're a point over, a point less, Halakh Lamas, we're not going to basically stick with over here. So if you have a suffix, how much is your tefet? Your hand is basically a tefah. Approximately, what is the size over here is the amount that has to be torn for the Mrs. Kriya. You'd be surprised. How many of us, I'm not sure, Rabbi Jorkin has seen as well, that you have people who are well-meaning supervise Kriya, but the Kriya is very shallow, either it's a horizontal Kriya, or it's not long enough. Then basically tear down to have basically a vertical cut itself. A tefah, there's a machloikis, the Ramosha holds a tefah is about 3.5 inches. The Chazanis says that's 3.8 inches. If you are approximating, you're allowed to approximate. In other words, since Magnitin Atel Machle Shares, if you're a point over, a point less, Halakh Lamas, we're not going to basically stick with over here. So if you have a suffix, how much is your tefa? Your hand is basically a tefa. Approximately, what is the size over here is the amount that has to be torn for the Mrs. Kriya. You'd be surprised. How many of us, I'm not sure, Rabbi Jorkin has seen as well, that you have people who are well-meaning supervised Kriya, but the Kriya is very shallow, either it's a horizontal Kriya, or it's not long enough. Be careful to make sure it's done Kalbacha, and basically speaking, is that specific dimension. Now, the Kriya has to be done Ba'anida. We possibly, if you do the Kriya, the Yeshiva, you have to do it again. Unless, of course, obviously you're a chayla mutul lamita, where in that case you have to ask the chayla shayla. Do you have to tell a person who's deathly in the hospital that Karav has died to Mekayim Mitzvah Kriya? The answer is, if this person is that deathly ill and the cause in Tiva Hadas, Hamaiti Diba Hare Kasil, you don't tell them. And in fact, many times you have people who are chayla in the hospitals in order to take away from them the chiv of Shiva. When I'm a galu, then this is so until basically speaking after this month, until after Shloshim, in order they should have a chiyav a shiva upon hearing Nebuchadnezzar when the son that the karav has died. Yes.
According to my note, the kriyas the rabbanon and bal pashas be deraisa.
It wouldn't necessarily be. See, there's machlok and foskin whether about well the machlal the bal pashas outside cutting down fruit trees whether that's the deraisa of the rabbanon. Machlok amongst the rishonim. So I'm saying to you that theoretically you want to say that according to that man Amba who says the bal pashas deraisa while kriyas the rabbanon. So you're asking how one obviates the other one. The answer is that once you're doing it for mitzvah purpose, it's no longer hashkasa. Kima mitzvah automatically means it's being done to construct rather than for destructive purposes. That is why the Tesis had the concept of surf and al-hamalachim. They used to destroy the malachim's kalim, bal hashkas. The answer is it's being done for the constructive kavod hamalchus. That took away the ease of bal hashkas. Who had in kam. Now, let us continue, Rabbi Isai. Yes? Theoretically speaking, the concept of a Kriya B'Shas Amid is for everybody in the room. What we have, interesting enough, is theoretically speaking, you should have doctors and nurses having big day Kriyim continuously, Rahman al-Islam. There seems to be a special, even though the halacha we should hear Kriya, there's a special exemption that Klal Yisrael were given that developed over the centuries. And the reason, they basically said, whoever's not a Karo, even though they should tear Kriya, we exempt them. The reason they did this is they're fearful that people would have a Chiyuv Kriya, they would leave the person, the Shasitis Neshama, which would cause them spiritual Yisugim. Chazal say the worst thing you do for a person who's dying is to let them die alone, with nobody in the room. So to prevent from people leaving the room, they shouldn't be the Shasitis Neshama, to have a Chiyuv Kriya, Chazal exempted you from the Chiyuv Kriya, even though you should do it, people are not knowing to do it today. So that's basically the heter, why doctors and nurses don't tear Kriya Bizman Hazeh. Okay, now, I want to mention to you that when it comes to Kriya at interesting times during the year, for instance, a person who has a Karov who dies on Yom Tov, okay? And the halacha is Kriya is not doyech as Shabbos Yom Tov, so obviously speaking, if a person dies on Shabbos Yom Tov, you delay the Kriya till afterwards. What happens if a person dies on Yom Tov and the Kriya is going to take place during Chol HaMoed? Do I tear Kriya during Chol HaMoed? So over here, the Shulchan Aruch brings down a slew of shitas. There are some poskim who held that since the niyug of Shiva is not going to take place after Yom Tov anyway, there's no Shiva during Chol HaMoed, we should perhaps delay the Kriya till after the Yom Tov and basically do it during the week of Shiva. There are others, this is called the meaning Ashkenaz, to do the Kriya, basically speaking, during Chol HaMoed itself, since that's B'shas Chim, when you're doing the Maisa Kvuga. So basically undermining Yom Tov anyway for that purpose, you should do Kriya at that specific time as well. So on the marketplace, there are different minhagim. The more prevalent minhag, which seems to be the more minhag in Nachum, is to do during Chol HaMoed, not to unduly delay this till basically at the end. There are also different shitas amongst the poskim. Some poskim say that only an Ava'ein of the Sechiv and Shachrov, you should delay it. Some say there's no difference across the rule. So over here, you'll see in Shulchan Aruch about four different shitas amongst the poskim. And once again, you have a right to machria according to which you feel is the more consensus opinion. I will tell you, from the Geshe Chaim, you get the feeling he feels the most appropriate thing is to do it across the board for everybody, b'shas chim and b'shas kvur itself. That seems to be, by him, the more consensus opinion. So somebody raise their hand? No? Okay. Now, let's go further over here. Now, I want to mention to you that even for a child, a little baby, their parents die. Over here, there's a heart-rendering halacha that's brought down by the poskim, is for the sake of agnes nefesh, they sometimes tore a little bit symbolic of the child's beged to show symbolically the patira of its parents, if that's what never happened. Once again, it's not a chiv of kriya, the child's not complete. Mitzvah is not even gila chinuch, it's a little baby, but to show the affiliation of the child with the parents' loss, to cause other people to have basically the feeling of tzad to try for help the child take care of the teres yosam. So here Chazal initially was called a kriya b'shul agnes nefesh. There's no shir, it's a miksas just to basically show an affiliation between the child and the tragedy of losing his parents.
Okay, let us continue now. Now, I want to mention to you that one of the most important parts of the Chevra Kedisha's activities relates to the actual preparation of the body. This is where, really, I would say the Chevra Kedisha adds its special stamp of uniqueness in dealing with the concept of Kavod HaMes. One thing is for sure, that during the Zman of preparation of the body, on one hand, we're concerned with cleansing the body should be as clean as possible, and to dress the body with clean tachrichim. By doing such, we're basically affirming our belief in Tchiyas HaMesim. Secondly speaking, we want to make sure that during the time of the cleansing the body and dress the body, we try to maintain the Kavod HaMes and Tznius. And that is why, even though we're going to uncover the body to do washing of the body, those parts that are not being washed are usually kept covered to maintain the tznius of the body during the entire time period of the actual tahara itself. The reason it's called the tahara, and the reason it's called the chevra kedisha, is because the osek with the human being's body, which is a davar shel kedusha, a davar shel tahara. And therefore, to give us the understanding that this person therefore deserves a sanctified type of dealing with their body, a process of cleansing, the process is called tahara, and the people involved in it is called the chevra kedisha, shehein oskim b'kedoshe aret. That's where the whole source of this term comes from. The basic idea in dealing with tahara is the following. They basically take the body into a room, into a tahara room, if you're working in what obviously people call up. There's a special table they have available. And the idea is you try to wash the body down in some type of semblance of derech kavod. You wash the top of the body first, and you move down towards the bottom of the body. You usually wash the top of the head first, then you do the right side of the body first, then the left side of the body first. You never turn the body on, we call face down, because that's considered design day, because basically when you want to wash the back, is you move the best on the side, in order to basically allow the body to be washed, but they're covered during the entire time period. After you physically wash the entire body, there are some who have the minhag of trimming the nails, some don't have the minhag of trimming the nails. That's based upon different minhagim. When it comes to final preparations, we call the tahara of the shiva of the tisha kav, pouring the water on the mess itself. This is blessedly done by having the two people hold the mess and the third person pouring the water over the mess's body. This is called the tahara of tisha kav. There was a time, and there still are people who are knowing, besides Tisha Kavim, to be told with a mess in the mikveh. That is not a sine qua non, that's not a halach mandate. But today in our society, when people are becoming frumma day and night, and they want to be frumma now, even some of the most secular funeral parlors to basically draw Orthodox Jews in are basically advertising to have a mikveh on the premises. It's interesting. Some shul that have mikveh on the premises, these funeral parlors do. And these mikvahs, basically speaking, are available. They usually have hoists in there so they can move the body in and out without the Chevra Kedisha pulling themselves into the mikveh themselves. And some of the funeral parlors today have really very interesting modern equipment to make the job a pretty easy endeavor. After the body is washed to halakha, some people have meaning of doing what's called the bedika pnimis, which they basically pour water into the body to try to clean out the intestinal tract as well. The body should be clean the pnimi b'chutz as much as possible. Some people are knowing this, some people are not knowing this. Some people make a special effort to clean out the actual genital organs to basically make sure they're clean as well. The idea is to make the body as clean and as presentable as possible. After you basically have done the cleansing of the body, and every Chevra Kedisha you will see, if you read manuals, has their own minhagim of how to basically wash the body. Some wash it this way, some wash it that way, some wash it with sponges, without sponges. Everybody has their own way of doing it. But one common denominator, it's done by derech kavod. Anybody who's ever been a member of a Chevra Kedisha realizes they're a very special group of people. They're serious people, very, very, very covetous people, because to be involved in this continuously requires a certain amount of kavod rosh, a certain amount of respect you have for human beings. Not all bodies that come into a Chevra Kedisha are clean and free, especially people who never had operations and died in operations. I mean, people sometimes come in with tubes sticking out of their body. Many times people die in ICU units. The hospital doesn't want to spend the time and the manpower to take the tubes out of the body, so they strip the whole body with the tubes that are inside from intravenous to the funeral parlor, let them have the headache. What the Chevra Kedisha has to do is not only take the tubes out of the body, they have to basically close up the holes, have to basically, the body's still bleeding, many times it is, they have to basically use special chemicals to dry up the blood, to clot the blood, because you can't wash the body if the body's still bleeding. There are now phenomenal chemicals on the marketplace that can do this very quickly, but obviously, therefore allow you to speed up your process as quickly as you possibly can.
We in the Chevron Kedisha of the Queens usually are makbid not to have less than 3 to 4 people doing a Tahara. The reason we feel that to give maximum kavanah mes, it's better to have more people working together in unison. It's a quicker type of Tahara. It's more bekavik to have 2 or 3 people holding at the body rather than to have one person. I can tell you there's some practitioners on the marketplace who are known to do a Tahara single-handed. Now, to do a Tahara single-handed, what that means very simply is to wash down the body is a halbutza. To do a tisha kavim single-handed means you have to literally somehow maneuver the mess with yourself and hold the mess against the wall, and literally with the other hand pour the water over it. I mean, but obviously too much covered mess is not involved in this, but there are practitioners on the marketplace that do this. Therefore, if you're called as a rabbanim to recommend chevra kadisha, make sure you quality control who you're recommending to. You shouldn't recommend to people who basically are charlatans and not really giving the covered mess that is properly due them. When it comes to dressing with tachrichim, our minig, based upon the famous new Rav Gamliel and Sechlis Samei Katan, is to use cheap, inexpensive begadim made from, basically speaking, from flax. Big day kishtim. And the reason is very simply, the Gemara has 2 reasons. Number one is, shalol levayish misha'ino, not to embarrass people who are not able to. There used to be a time, believe it or not, in Klal Yisrael, people used to compete even when it came to funerals. Some people used to be dressed in tuxedos, some people used to be dressed in rags, and when people couldn't keep up with the Joneses, the Gemara says, people were embarrassed to dress their karov in cheaper begotten than everybody else. They used to be meniach and semes because they couldn't keep up with those fashions and run in the opposite direction. The Gemara tells Rav Gamliel, upon seeing this, we made it tzibui, a lesser one testament, which became many halakha, that henceforth any mess has to have the same quality begging as everybody else. It has to be cheap flax. You can't basically dress in regular begotten anymore. And based upon that, the kana, our many therefore is to use flax. I will tell you, in the marketplace, there's flax and there's flax. You know, there's flax that's cheap quality, better quality, even that is a business, is an industry. But nevertheless, the meaning is to use a flax type of beggar, not to use anything fancier than that. There's surely, it's against our law to dress somebody with a tuxedo and a suit, lahabul, the way that they do, and it's surely against our halakha to allow a wake to take place, but let the body be viewed, because that's classically the ideal form of seeing the body in a state of dishevelment, a state of nivel. And could obviously have considered one of the highest forms of nivel mess you can perform, besides actually being doing nivel to the actual body itself. So wakes are totally antithetical to our concept of covered mess. That's why you machas the body from the time of Petira to the actual kibbutz itself. So the body is not viewed. The only people who see the body really are the Chevra Kedisha during the time of their physical cleansing of the body itself. The tachrichim are made different ways. They're primarily it's like Bigdei Kahuna, Lahavdol. There's basically mechnasayim for the bottom part. It's basically coverings for the top of the like a shirt. It's basically like a little coat above that. There aren't any buttons on it. Basically, there are tags that basically go into one another. It has a gartel, basically as another form of it. There are parts that cover the feet. There are parts that cover the top of the head. The whole body, by the time you finish with the tzrich, basically covered around with this very beautiful, inexpensive white material. There's then what's called at the end a sove, a piece of material that's wrapped around the body as a final finishing touch. It looks like a mummy at the end by the time they basically finished it up. There is a minig for people buried in chutz laaretz to have afa eretz or put on their head, or put next to them. Therefore, some people basically speaking have a minig sometimes of putting pieces of shear in the eyes and putting afa eretz upon that. Some put afa eretz on the head, on top of the head, some put it in the back of the head. There are different halachos. The idea is based upon a segula that if you bury with afa eretz Yisrael, that will guarantee the body being brought back to eretz Yisrael. It's shas chias amazing. It's, you know, it's a guarantee, so to speak. I do want to mention to you, Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal said that besides everything else, the Rambam seems to say the reason you use cheap material is because of baltashkas. What's the purpose of burying a very person in a fancy suit if it's going to basically self-destruct from the karka? And that is why Rav Soloveitchik said that's why our meaning is also when it comes to burying a person in a casket to use as cheap as casket as possible. Not that Rav Soloveitchik said wood would be a chatzitza. We paskin that wood can be used, any quality wood can be used, but the idea is wood decomposes. Wood is basically is a decomposing factor like the human body, and it has a pretty similar rate of decomposition. Based upon that, therefore, he theoretically speaking, bury a person in any type of wood coffin, and that would suffice according to halakha, as long as there aren't any nails or metals in the actual framework of the specific coffin. The reason why Makban on a cheap coffin is because Rav Soloveitchik is baltashlis. Why put a piece of furniture that's worth $10,000 on the ground? If you can put something worth a couple hundred dollars, it's not going to be more covered a mess. If you better take that money to make a new type of kollel program in YU or some other institution, wherever based on itself, to use the money to support Torah, than to put it in a way that's like, literally putting money into the ground. Throwing money into the ground. That's the classical literal definition of that type of pe'ula. So therefore, Soloveitchik therefore counseled his rabbanim that they should always try to advise people to get cheaper caskets and give the money to tzedakah instead. I will tell you, however, sometimes you will have hashva, sometimes you will not have hashva. The ikar hakpad you have to have is, it should be a wood casket, and that means the exclusion of the metal casket. The only time metal is ever used is transporting a person from here to Eretz Yisrael, you have to put dry ice in, whether you have no choice. There has to be a legal inner lining to allow the body to go on an airline to be transported to Eretz Yisrael. The body is not buried with that type of casket, it's just a question of transportation. But otherwise, the casket does not have any metal in it. I also want to mention to you that kfur has to be done by karka. Kavod sig berenet. The body has to be returned back to earth in which it came. Over here, chazal means literally it has to be kfur bekarka. That is why, by definition, kfura in a mausoleum has major halachic problems. A mausoleum might be mukubal bekarka, but it's not kfur bekarka. I mean, especially the Muslims that we make today, the main such a way that the body is tried to be preserved and stayed above ground without, but obviously the earth coming causing this decomposition. If anything, is preventing ichul habasa. The concept of the body basically undergoing decomposition is crucial to the kaparas HaMes, and that's why we want the body to be returned to the kever as quickly as possible to facilitate the ichul habasa. So kavur by karki is a sine qua non. It's based upon the part of kavur sig berenu b'yoyin ha'hu. There's a lashon exerus kasuk and pashas ki seitzei. Now, I do want to mention to you that there's some places around the world, especially in the south of the United States, where they have a major problem with their cemeteries. They're continuously inundated with water. So what they do in these types of areas, based upon local law, is they have to bury the person with cement encasements. I don't know if you ever heard of it about this before, but I'm sure you're going to be confronted with this in your life. And the shayla is, can you bury a person in a cement encasement in the karka? That kavur b'karka. The psak, the emotion others have given very simply is, since that cement is permanently fixed in the ground, becomes bundled to the karka, kfur in that, therefore, that cement encasement is therefore kim kfur bekarka, and could obviously speaking, you can use it. It's surely not ideal if you don't have to use it, but if you have to use it, halacha maaseh, since it's put in the ground first before the mess is put in, it's considered bakul bekarka, and that's considered a kim kfur bekarka itself. Okay, I also want to mention to you that when it comes to the kfura, the chevra kadisha were always from time immemorial involved. But not only preparing the body, but being involved in Hitzos HaMes. Being allowed the mess to the action for itself if they possibly can. The quality control it. And therefore, that's why you have the concept in the Gemara mentions Masal Ksafim, that the professional Chevra Kadisha were the ones who were the pallbearers who carried the Aram, were Misasik for Isai Dover from beginning to end. Over here I will mention to you that Kvur Bekarka has various Minhagim surrounding it. One interesting minig is, and this you probably see in the basic pharaohs, you probably wonder why, is that when you start filling up the hole, after you put the body in, they use the back of the shovel. Anybody ever know why they use the back of the shovel before they use the actual shovel first? Where that comes from, what the source of that is? If you have to cover up the body, why do you start with the back of the shovel first? Anybody have any idea? What? No. It's a symbolic reason. The symbolic reason is the concept of kosher l'pri dasan. It's difficult for me to fill up the kever to basically depart from you. If anybody has ever been in Avelis, there's always the feeling of, on the part of the mishpacha, to not come to grips, to basically disbelieve this has happened. The time when I realized this death had taken place, and this is the body being lowered into the ground, there's no longer rejection, there's no longer disbelief. And therefore, in order to symbolically say, kosher l'pri dasan, it's difficult for me to bury you here, to basically depart from you, we start up the pushing of the earth with the back of the shovel, which is more difficult, and once you start basically being mechatz a little bit, you turn the right side up, and you basically start putting in the dirt the right way. It's an interesting minig Israel. The second minig I want to mention to you is not to hand the shovel from one to another. That's based upon the concept, the belief, you should not be moshit tzara mi'ish l'chavera. Symbolically, I don't want to wish you any type of avelus in the future. Each person takes the shovel by themselves and they don't hand it one to another. It's one of these minhagim. Now, I love it. These are minhagim of nihugim that have taken place over the centuries. It's important as a rabbanim, you should be familiar with these minhagim because people are going to judge you based upon your knowledge of this when it comes to your supervision of what's going on out there. The tefillos you recite at a Beis HaKfaros are the following. You usually recite a lashon of tzidukadin, That is usually done by the Avelim. Many times there are people who come along who will recite this in unison together with the Avelim. That is usually done either right before the interment or right after the interment, after the actual mess is put into the karak itself. There's a meaning also to say a Mala Rachamim, say Kemala at the actual, after the karak itself. There's a special nusach of Kaddish called the Kaddish Lis Charika, where basically that's the Kaddish which talks about the concept of Tchias Mesim. That Kaddish you recite when you also make a Sim HaMasechta. So that preamble, that Hakdamah, is said at the time of the actual Kfur itself. When Kfur takes place in days, if Hamish Tachanin is not said, you delete that Haskalah and you say normal Kaddish, Kaddish Derabanan, or basically Kaddish, Kaddish Yasa. So only when basically you can basically say Tachanun, you say this new type of Kaddish called the Kaddish Lis Charika at the time of the actual end of the Kfur itself. I also will mention to you that the Haskalah Avelis begins with the actual placement of the mess into the karka. As soon as you fill up the kever, the mesim, based upon that, are mukliv and avelis immediately. The way we demonstrate that is by forming two parallel lines upon the actual filling up of the kever, and allowing symbolically the mishpacha to walk through the two lines. At that point in time, the people who were staying on those lines say hamaki minachem eschem, to basically start the form of nichma avelim. Some people have meaning at that point to take off the shoes to show that the Issa Nidlis sandal has begun immediately. Some people delay the Issa sandal being taken off until they get back to the car, until they basically get back home. But I always tell people, make sure that in the minds of the Avelim, that at that point in time they sit down momentarily to makalah upon themselves Avelis, that should be considered day one. Many times you'll have tours taking place this time of year, and by the time you get out of the cemetery, it'll be 4 o'clock, by the time you get home, they can sit down, it'll be Amish after Shkia and after Tzeis. They'll be forfeiting one day. Why waste an entire day? Halach could never make of the other. Miksa hayom kiyom. For this reason, I always advise people in the basic forest in a couple of Avelis symbolically. Once you do that, even though most of the time you're not going to be sitting in the car until you get home, you already have the masli Avelis. Day one has been fulfilled, you only have 6 days more. You try to make it easy, we don't try to make it harder for these specific people. So you have to supervise. It's going to be upright to remind people, because people forget, people don't think upon this thing. Some people also have a meaning if they don't want to change the shoes at the basic course, to put some sand in the shoes to walk back with the regular shoes to show that they basically try to walk away the Hanoah, Nilas and Alayan, until they basically go home. It's another meaning that exists as an alternative. I want to ask you if you have any questions. I mean, I've been talking for the last hour and a half, and I'm stopped if you have my interest. Yes?
What's the meaning of the Minhag when we put a stone on the monument?
It's basically a sign of Pegidas HaKever. I was here. It's a symbolic statement. It's more of a Kabbalistic statement. It's not ma'ake. It's just a way of showing me there are kavod. I was here and I put a stone here to show I made my dent, so to speak, and I come to visit. It's not ma'ake. But it's just a symbolic statement. Symbolic statement, that's all it is. There's also another symbolic thing people do at the end of a kura. They take a piece of grass and they pluck it up from the ground and they throw it over their shoulders. That's based upon a reaffirmation of a belief in Tchias HaMeisim. The same way grass regenerates itself, we believe this body will regenerate itself with Zman HaTchiyah. So that's a Kabbalistic statement to once again say that type of thing. We tell Avelim, the same way this grass will basically be regenerated, your mess will be rejoined with you at some future time. It's amazing. It's a good gesture to say to the Krovim as a form of their Nichumim at that point in time. Any other questions anybody has? I'm in Hagen. Yes?
Something that they say kill, they run into a problem, they can't.
You saw the type of loyal Rashmi.
Yeah.
So over there, the concept of burying a person in the talus, or in tzitzit baklav, where you can talk about the meaning of burying the
talus. I don't know. Is it saying hill or even some people they go for an avail, but then somebody says he makes remarks and says bar Torah. Is that problem not problematic?
So over here, the answer is an excellent question. The answer is that any divrei Torah that's the tzorach hames, of kavod hames, is not a violation of loy l'rosh. That's why at Hespedim, at a funeral parlor, the rav makes a drasha, sometimes a very lengthy drasha, of kavod hames, even though the mess is right in front of him. Why is it in the shale of loy l'rosh? The answer is because it'd be done, it's covered to the mess. Same thing would apply when it goes to an unveiling, where you come to the monument and you basically are basically saying divrei Torah, the kavod hames. With St. Hillam, since it's begun with Kavod HaMes, not considered an Issa of Loig L'Rush. You're not mocking the person since the Chafin Shem Mitzvah, you're saying the Rekara. Over here, you're not saying to show that you're Alam, you say it because you want to give them the schus of this limit at Peira. Chazal tells any time you do a mitzvah on behalf of the Nifter, it raises them to a higher level in Olam HaMes. That's why Chazal said, Kapil Anuch HaShefet Issa, If you look in that pasuk in Sefer Devarim on the Rabbeinu Bachya, Ben Asher, he says what that means is afilu meisim tzrich kapara, that anytime you do a devar mitzvah on behalf of a dead person, give tzedakah, say divrei Torah, dedicate something, it gives that mess a zechia, an added merit to their specific spiritual merit, therefore raising to a higher level of olam emes. So therefore your satisfaction of divrei Torah is basically accomplishing this. I will tell you, some people sometimes have a chumra of the marked dalaramas from the kevah. That perhaps you will see, some people are marked it. That depends upon whether you're basically learning a daf yemi over there, or you're saying kapitul tehillim. You know, if you're mamish being kavei yeshiva, for isam often, then people feel it's more appropriate to be marked dalaramas to do mamish al gabi hakevah itself. That you'll have different minhagim. But the idea is, kavad ames is what takes away this entire problem. Our meaning is the very person with their talus. In Eretz Yisrael, you will see the minig is not to bury a person in the talus. The whole reason not burying a person in the talus is because Chazal said, since the mess is part of the mitzvahs, aren't you mocking by saying I'm burying you in an object, you basically came a kind of mitzvah with. Our minig in Chutz La'aretz is to bury with the talus, but what we do before you ultimately put the person in the karka is you pass one of the tzitzis. So that the person should have a chiyuv mitzvah that he cannot be mekayim. And there itself, since they feel that you're not chayiv at all, why even put yourself in that type of ischayivus? They don't bury you with the talus at all. So this is basically from minhagi hamaka. In fact, Eretz Yisrael, they're so mocked that even if the best comes from Chutz L'Eretz Yisrael, based upon the concept of chumrei hamakom, they take the talus off the mess, they don't allow you to bury this mess with the talus, where everybody else in all the batik person, Eretz Yisrael, buried without talus.
I think I saw it.
What?
I think I saw
it being buried without talus. And I hope the Chavrin didn't see it. they're usually very mocked to take it off. What? That is a possibility. That is a possibility. I will also tell you, Rabbi Isai, that there are times, according to halakha, that you will not perform a tahara. For instance, if a person could obviously was killed, a haruk, and we therefore want to cause a hisromus of charanach of a kaddish baruch hu. So over there are some who hold at that point in time you do not do a tahara. Let the person, especially in the style of dama nefesh. What's considered damanesh, not damanesh, we sometimes bury the person by just wrapping them with general wrappings around. We don't wash out the body, commit the body to burial that way. Yes? What? Anytime, in America, we pass the talus. Or we have another option, you put the talus, one of them inside the actual, sometimes some talus are made with little casements, that you basically put it in, to basically show and demonstrate that I don't have a four-corner baguette anymore with the tzitzis. But the minigin, is to bury with the talus, that one of the sisters have been passing. The idea is, see, in Eretz Yisrael, theoretically speaking, the chiyuv of gvura takes place as soon as you possibly can. But in Eretz Yisrael, we have an additional problem. There's the isur of tumas arutz, which we don't have in America. So since the isur was tamis ad maspa, then we try to commit the body to burial as quickly as possible. And then to bury at night. In America, where there's no problem with tamis ad maspa, we can therefore delay the burial for the next day also. There's another problem legally. The cemeteries don't want you to, since they have unions, they don't want to have the cemetery used in the evening. They want that when the workers are not working, the cemetery should not be used, period. And that's why we had a couple of years ago strikes, we had major problems opening up the cemetery to commit our people to burial. And you were still in diapers, I mean, we had service literally the days cemeteries were closed and the bodies were basically accumulating. Like major problems, we had to have court orders to at least let us declare to have that bodies interred. And there it's not because of the Isla Satanis Admas, and also because of the Kedusha of Arei Feima. We therefore commit the body to burial even during the night time. Since we have quality control of it, we don't have unions, at least not the unions we have in America, we can basically make these types of arrangements. Okay, any other questions about Beis Sai? If not, I think we covered a great deal of material that's on tape. So your Rebbe will know exactly where we stopped, and he basically can continue in suit. I want to wish you a lot of hatzlacha, and I tell you, you're going into a very exciting field. But one thing is for sure, that to be successful in this field, you need a lot of knowledge at your fingertips. And if a zeal gemar, spend your time accumulating this knowledge, and I wish you a lot of hatzlacha. Good job.
Thank you.